Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of January 20th, 2012. Stop eating out. Don't buy that $3 latte. Hey, you tired of hearing that yet?
When you tell them to stop spending money on lattes, simply look at the last 20 years. Is it working? No.
So let's explore some different ways to improve the big picture. For employees of some companies, that big picture would improve with the shedding of extra pounds, which translate into extra cash.
It wasn't the $60. It was, wow, I lost that much weight to get to $60.
Paying for a lighter workforce. Plus, she's a panelist on ABC's Shark Tank, and Barbara Corcoran isn't going to make things easy for anybody.
I'm deciding already whether I have any interest in investing in that business or not, because I'm watching that individual and seeing how good they are under pressure.
Why sniffing out talent is about more than creative ideas and solid business plans. Those stories and more on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
Time to hit the rewind button on the week that was, and of all things, food stamps became a hot topic in the presidential campaign this week. During a Republican debate in South Carolina, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich repeated this claim.
More people have been put on food stamps by Barack Obama than any president in American history.
Gingrich and other Republican candidates say the current administration's policies encourage Americans to become dependent on government welfare programs. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is here to check in on that story. Hey, John.
Hello, Tess.
So first I have to ask you if it's nice finally having more people around town these days now with Congress getting back into session, or is it kind of nice when they're gone?
It's actually nicer when they're gone. You can find parking spaces and a seat on the metro.
Right. But at least there is some news to be made at this point. And Newt Gingrich certainly made some news this week with what he said about President Barack Obama being the food stamp president. What did you find in your reporting about this?
Well, 45 million Americans are getting food stamps now, and the cost to taxpayers is $75 billion a year. And that cost has doubled since 2008. These are all record levels. And I discovered that food aid is hardly just a welfare program. Nearly a third of the people who are eligible for food stamps have a job, but they don't earn enough to feed themselves. For example, there's Melissa Cahill, a 24-year-old single mother in Derry, New Hampshire. She and her daughter have been getting food stamps for 5 years now, despite Melissa's job at a restaurant.
I'm only working part-time right now, and I pay my own rent and bills and gas and all that stuff. I wouldn't have any money at the end of my paycheck to buy food for me and her, so it does help me out a lot.
And John, as you mentioned, you know, those numbers, as you say, have doubled since 2008. Well, that certainly coincides right there with the economic crisis, doesn't it?
Absolutely. This is economically driven. You know, these people are earning between $130 to $200 a month. And Joe Ellen Ringer in Boise, Idaho, was another food stamp recipient I talked to. She told me, you know, that doesn't go very far. She was a recipient for 9 months after she lost her job in 2008.
I bought no meat at all, no chips, no candy. I just bought like cans of stew, cans of soup, stretching it as carefully as I could, because $136 does not go very far.
And right now, she's volunteering at her local food bank in Boise, where she's seen the clientele increase dramatically.
Do you think that they're welfare bums? They aren't. They've worked hard all their life and have never, ever needed or wanted any government help. This is a pretty proud state of self-starters. Pretty ornery about government interference in any way, shape, or form. And it's shameful to need government help in any way. When you don't have a job, your pride's kind of gone.
So, John, she has gone from being a food stamp recipient to now working at a local food bank?
She volunteers at the food bank.
Wow. John, really interesting stories there.
It's a real different story from what the Republican candidates for president are charging, that this is too much dependence on government welfare.
Well, let's move on to another topic that came up in Washington this week, which is the housing situation, which has obviously been a complicating factor for a lot of folks out there. And it seems that the government may be close to a deal with the banks that could help avoid some foreclosures.
Yeah, this has been a long time coming. Federal and state governments have been negotiating for over a year with the banks and other mortgage lenders over the way they mishandled foreclosures.
Hmm.
Remember all those robo-signing scandals
right.
last year? Well, this settlement will force the lenders to reduce the actual principal of their loans, something that they've been very reluctant to do. But it's a recognition that since 2007, there's been a 30% average decline in home values.
But we don't have a deal on that yet, right?
Right. And it's so sensitive because so many people who've been struggling figure they deserve a break, especially if they find out that the neighbor's got a better deal.
Right.
There's going to be a whole complicated set of rules for who's the most deserving. There's probably some complicated income thresholds, personal worth, credit scores and the like. But the White House says the deal should help prevent more than a million foreclosures.
We'll wait for final resolution on that. Meantime, our John Dimsdale joining us from our Washington Bureau. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
One of my pet peeves in the personal finance world is this notion that there is one right way to manage and think about your money. For example, using credit cards is always bad. Well, no. If credit cards work for you, great. If they don't, that's okay too. Or how about the new housing crisis rule? Nobody should own, everybody should rent. Well, no, it's more complex than that. So I like it when someone in the personal finance space dares to sacrifice our sacred cows. We're going to talk in a moment with Ramit Sethi, best-selling author of I Will Teach You to Be Rich, and we're going to address what we'll call the latte factor. But first, a clip from a commentary he did for us a few months ago.
Have you ever noticed that personal finance experts love lecturing Americans about what they can't do with their money? They say things like, stop spending money on lattes. You can't afford those jeans. Eating out? You should cook at home every night. Duh. The only problem is, these tips haven't worked for the last 50 years.
Duh. Ramit joins us now to delve into this perhaps a little more deeply. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a topic that I think tends to come up at this time of year, particularly around New Year's, when you start hearing all of the various ways that you can save money and bring your budget down. Why does that not work?
It's a classic mistake that experts make. They sit in their rooms, they come up with an idea that sounds logical, keep a budget, don't spend money on lattes, and they write it up in a book or they go on the radio or they go on the internet and they say it. The problem is they never actually stop to test it and see if people actually follow that advice.
And your argument is that they don't.
They don't. We know for a fact that they don't. People do not keep budgets. When you tell them to stop spending money on lattes, simply look at the last 20 years. Is it working? No. So if somebody comes and says, no, 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 you can't do that with your money, what's the first thing I say to them?
Yes, 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 I can.
Exactly.
It's my money.
It's my money, and I'm not going to listen to what this person's telling me I can't do.
But I think what always strikes people is the math. And, you know, you'll read these stories where if you cut out that latte for 1 week, yeah, it's only going to save you $5. But for your lifetime, it's going to cost you $20 million, right?
Right.
That's pretty stark.
It's a marketing hook that people use. I could create 50 marketing hooks right now, but that's not the way people really work. We operate on a basis of psychology, right? Our immediate needs and wants versus our long-term wants and needs. And there are ways to balance both of those, and that's really what we're talking about. When you have someone coming in and saying you can't do X, Y, Z, the first thing we do is a psychological term called reactance. Hmm. And that's what happens when we say someone's trying to take away what I feel is my right, and I instantly put up my defenses. Instead, what about doing something different? Why don't we talk about things like, look, automate your money so that part of it is automatically going to your savings. And if you do that, you could spend as much money as you want on lattes. Or focus on the big wins in life. How come we're not talking about negotiating your salary? That's a $5,000 to $10,000 win right there. That's worth more than $1 million over your career. Or improving your credit. By the way, the difference between someone who goes to buy a house with poor credit and excellent credit, that's over $100,000. So there are big wins in our life. And if we just get these 5 to 6 big wins done, we don't have to worry about the little things like lattes or if I'm buying a medium or small size Coke when I eat out.
But how can cutting back on your spending be a bad thing?
There's a cost for everything. We are what's called cognitive misers. We have limited cognition and limited willpower.
I'm not a miser.
We are all misers, Tess. I'm a cognitive miser. You know how you know this? Because you wake up in the morning and there's 50 things you could do with your money. You could pay off that debt. You could buy those shoes. You could go out to drinks. And faced with these 50 decisions, what do we do?
We're going to spend some money.
We're going to do the same thing we've always done. And so what a lot of the latest psychological research shows us is that if we can narrow these choices down, we can actually make better decisions. And we know this intuitively. Think about it. When you go to work and you have 50 things on your to-do list, you end up doing none of them. If you have three, you're going to knock those out. So lattes, there's a cost to that. You're using part of your treasured willpower. Would you rather spend that limited willpower on something like a $3 expenditure, or would it rather be spent on something like earning more money, automating your money, or you're going to buy something. Should you buy it on your credit card? Should you not? Etc. Those are worthy of our willpower. A $2 purchase, it's not important in the grand scheme of things.
Ramit Sethi joining us in the studio here in Los Angeles. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And if you need any further proof that the best watch phrase for your money is moderation in all things, here's commentator Felix Klick with his story of frugality gone awry.
For most of my life, my financial competency was average. I didn't have a history of overspending or consumer debt, but I just wasn't that great about saving and planning for the future. 6 years ago, at 26, I decided to improve my financial literacy and focus on saving for my goals and planning for retirement. My first goal was to save up enough money to buy a house. Last October, I took the plunge. The house was a responsible purchase. It's well within my price range and is a good fit for my lifestyle and my job. Yet, I find I can't fully enjoy it because of the money mindset I've cultivated for the last 6 years. I've got this nagging sense that I should be saving as much as possible and never let my savings balance fall. I'm so focused on every expense that I'm missing out on the fun associated with this goal that I've worked so hard to achieve. I find little consolation in knowing I planned responsibly for this home, and I'm now obsessed with covering the cost of homeownership without being totally strapped. My girlfriend and I have owned the house for a couple of months now, but spending money on it hasn't grown any easier. I'm working to transform an outbuilding into a home office with an affordable, talented contractor who has made every step of this project nearly seamless. And yet, every step is darkened by my reluctance to spend money, even when that spending is planned responsibly and doesn't result in negative financial consequences, beyond the negative entry in my bank book. I struggle every day with actually enjoying what my planning and saving has made possible in my life, and that paradox is by far the biggest challenge associated with my increased financial literacy. It's also an indicator that it's time to rebalance my priorities and focus on my happiness literacy, so that next year, when I'm preparing the land for the garden I've saved so long to have, my enjoyment won't be tarnished by account balances.
Felix Klick lives, works, and worries about money in Black Mountain, North Carolina. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it is time once again in the show for your questions. Helping us out this week is Liz Weston, personal finance columnist for MSN. Hello, Liz.
Hi, Tess.
I wanted to get your take on this dust-up over Susie Orman. You know, we had her on the show last weekend, and a lot of people are talking about this new prepaid debit card. And I wanted to get your take on this as someone who knows the ins and outs of credit scores, because something that she's trying to do with this prepaid card is eventually make it so that those are counted as part of your credit score. What do you think about this?
Well, I think her intention is good. What she's talking about is that people who only use cash are being punished in the credit scoring system. And that's
right.
Essentially true. If you use cash, it's not building your credit. But mm-hmm. you do have to use a credit card, pay it off, you know, that kind of a thing. And what she wants to do is make that the case for a prepaid debit card so that people who use a cash equivalent somehow get credit in the credit scoring system.
Exactly.
Here's the problem. I think people are getting the misimpression that using her card will improve their credit.
Ah.
And that is not the case. All TransUnion has agreed to do is study the data and to see if there's anything predictive about cash transactions. And if you followed credit scoring for a while, you know there have been other attempts to use alternate data of some kind to predict how people will pay their credit accounts. Mm-hmm. None of it has gone anywhere. because the FICO scoring system is so entrenched, and the FICO scoring system basically says it wants to see you have and use actual credit accounts before you can even get a credit score.
Well, you say that there have been other studies of this kind of usage. Do you know what they have shown?
Experian a year ago made a big splashing announcement that it was going to start including rental payment information from landlords, from big landlords in its files. Again, people got the impression that their rental payments were somehow helping their FICO scores. They're not. FICO did not agree to use that information. So you may hear about these big announcements. Oh, we're going to finally reach out to the 50 million people who don't have credit scores and help them get a credit score. The reality is nothing has changed the actual FICO lending score that most people use, that most lenders use.
Well, I guess at the very least, what Susie Orman has done is thrown this back into the spotlight again and made people think about their FICO scores and tracking all that sort of thing.
And it's important. People need to think about this stuff. It's not something you can just ignore.
All right. Well, we are certainly not in the business of ignoring our callers. So shall we hit the phones?
Sounds great.
All right. Steve is with us from Worcester, Ohio. Hi there.
Hi there.
Now, am I pronouncing that correctly? Is it Worcester? Because I know in Massachusetts, it's Worcester.
It actually is the Massachusetts pronunciation. We go
with
Worcester. Yes.
Okay. Okay. Well, what do you do there in Worcester?
I'm a social worker for a mental health company.
What do you actually do?
I have dual roles. I am a counselor with patients themselves, but I'm also part of the management and administration.
I'm curious, given the economic situation over the last few years, are you finding a lot of people coming in with issues related to job loss and income loss, that sort of thing?
A great increase in that, and then the depression and the anxiety that goes along with that, and where are they going to get their next meal? Are they going to be able to maintain their house?
What piece of advice can you offer to folks who would be in that situation?
First of all, we have to make sure that they are dealing with those basic needs. You know, so try to get them linked with the various agencies that might, whether it's food stamps, you know, or unemployment, to make sure that they have those things coming in, because they won't be able to concentrate really well on things that might be adding to their depression or their anxiety if they have to worry about that basic day-to-day need.
Do you find that they don't know about those options in the first place, or is there something keeping them from taking advantage?
Both of those things. Sometimes people don't know about them, and then the other side of that coin is people who have the pride that keeps them from asking for help.
Right. And I guess, Liz, we would encourage anyone in that situation to set aside issues of pride. You got to take care of yourself.
You absolutely do. And there's actually a great government website, benefits.gov, where you can start, and in the privacy of your own home, start looking for things that may be able to help you.
Good. We'll put a link to that on our website. Well, thank you for doing that. That's a great service to your community.
Well, thank you.
All right. So how can we help you out? How can we be of service to you?
My question is, what recommendations would you have for how to unload a timeshare?
Oh, both Liz and I groan. So why did you buy it in the first place?
Well, 4 years ago, we took a trip to Orlando and got caught up in one of those ever-present kiosks.
Come for
just an hour presentation and, you know, get free discount tickets to something. And we went, listened, and they made some high-priced pitch, which we didn't buy into. And they came down with a much lower price spread, so to speak, which we did buy into. It has totally paid off.
But we've
also never used it.
Why?
Well, every time we have tried to use it, they've said we are full, or they've said we have to use a full week. We just haven't been able to get on board with it.
I, frankly, Liz, can relate. When I was in Hawaii a couple of years ago, there was an opportunity to go to one of these sessions. And I thought, you know what? These things work on people.
Yes. The most important thing I heard you say is that you've paid it off. Is that correct? You don't owe any money on this?
That is correct. We only pay the taxes and fees that are every 2 years.
The good news is because you have it paid off, it should be a lot easier. The people who are really stuck are the ones that have a huge loan. The first thing you need to do is go onto eBay and type in the exact name of your development and see if any timeshares have changed hands there. That will give you some idea of what the timeshare might be worth. I have another website to recommend. It's one of the oldest, if not the oldest, timeshare owners groups, and it's called tug2.net. And there you can go to get a lot of education about how to get rid of a timeshare. I think that's what drives a lot of their traffic is just people going, what do I do with this? I have heard, but I don't have direct knowledge, that you may be able, if you can't sell this thing, to donate it and get some kind of a tiny tax break. But it's not going to be a lot.
What, like to a nonprofit organization?
Yeah. Some nonprofits will take these. It's generally best to sell it if you can. But if you're really stuck, you may wind up being able to donate it.
Have you tried selling at all?
We have had companies call us from Florida where they want to take it to a convention.
Yes.
But it also costs you up to $1,000 to be listed with them.
Oh, and, so let me pay you some money so that so you can sell it for me?
Wow. And we have not done any of that.
Okay, good. I have not heard good results from paying other people, so I would take this into your own hands and do it yourself.
So, Steve, what lesson have you learned out of all this?
I'm going to take all of that advice. We are not buying into any of that. We get calls now from, you've just won, and we just delete all the time.
There you go.
All right. Thanks for the call, Steve.
Thanks, sure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, and next we go to Kathleen in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi, Tess. How are you?
Very well. Where is Fergus Falls?
Fergus Falls is a little east of Fargo.
Is it cold up there?
Yeah, it is. You know, we've had a very balmy winter so far, but it's quite frigid now, and I think we're going to have, I think January is finally going to make its required appearance now for a while. The sun is out today, so that helps.
Good. Glad to hear that. What do you do there?
Well, right now, I'm a stay-at-home mama. But in a prior life, I was a elder law attorney, sort of a public interest elder law attorney. But I traded that for, you know, Elmo and poopy diapers and the joys of motherhood.
How old is your child?
My daughter is a year and a half. We just had her year and a half checkup.
Well, how can we help you out today? Is this about perhaps a college account for your new daughter?
It is. My husband is about 2 weeks shy of his 59th birthday, and I'm 10 years behind him, so I'm going to turn 49, and I'm very familiar with using 529s for education. And my question is, for late-in-life parents, what about using a Roth? Because we don't have a 529 set up yet, but we both have Roths, and we're sort of anticipating that that would be the best vehicle to save for her college.
Interesting question, Liz, because, of course, any investment vehicle that they have, particularly when you start a 529, the key there is having a lot of years to be saving.
Yes.
Now, of course, we're certainly hoping that there are a lot of years left.
Yes.
with both Kathleen and her husband. Does this present any unique issues?
Well, there's a couple things. We have to think about the fact that we do have quite a few years for that money to grow. Regardless.
Right.
I think using a Roth IRA for college has become a bit of a fad, or, you know, recommendation. And I think what you need to think about is this. If you're overfunded for retirement and you're well on track, then using a Roth is probably fine. Obviously, you'll be in retirement mode by that time.
Let's just back this up a little bit for those who aren't following how you would use a Roth to fund an education. The reason is because you can withdraw your Roth money at any point. You can't withdraw the earnings on that money without taking a tax hit. But that's one of the benefits of the Roth, is that it is more liquid than a pre-tax investment. And so people can use it,
right,
say, to pay for a college education.
Exactly. The contributions can come out tax-free at any point, and the earnings can come out once your retirement age. And the mom's going to be 65 when her daughter goes off to college. The husband will be 75. So they'll be
right,
well within retirement age. So the big concern is, are we saving enough for retirement? Because retirement has to come first.
Right.
And a lot of parents want to put college education, college savings first. And I understand that as a parent, but really you have to make sure that you are totally on track for retirement. The other thing you need to think about is Roth IRAs are a great way to get money to your heirs. They're a great estate planning vehicle.
Right. Yep. Absolutely.
So this is something that, you know, I know you're an attorney and you know this stuff, but it may be worth going to a fee-only financial planner and kind of laying it out about, you know, which really is better. Because my preference generally is, yes, fund a Roth IRA, but keep that for your retirement for possible estate planning. Go ahead and do the 529. Because that money can be, you know, put aside, earmarked directly for college. Is there some reason why you don't want to do a 529?
No, not really, except I guess I just saw more versatility in a Roth, that we could use funds for both retirement as well as education, as opposed to being just limited for education with the 529.
Yeah.
Can you give us a sense of where your retirement savings are at?
I think we're well on track. You know, we don't carry any debt. We got a house paid off. I mean, we're in pretty good shape, and I do anticipate in the not-too-distant future, returning to work, and we both anticipate working probably into our 70s.
But, you know, the fact is that there is a limit on what you can put into a Roth. If you have the ability to, why not do both that and a 529?
Yeah, that's a good idea. Well, thank you, ladies.
All right, thanks for the call.
Enjoy that baby.
Very good, thanks.
Bye-bye, Kathleen.
Bye-bye.
All right, and next we go to Phil in Bardstown, Kentucky. Hi there.
Hey, how are you?
Very well. How are things going in Kentucky these days?
Well, we had a tornado about an hour ago.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, everything okay?
Everything's fine, just some trees blown over and stuff. But normally it's pretty cool, and we got some warm weather, and warm spring weather usually brings storms, and so it did.
So what do you do there?
I'm a business systems analyst during the day, and then on the weekends I'm a gentleman farmer of a little under 200 acres.
A gentleman farmer?
Ah. Yes.
Wow. What do you farm?
We do Hereford cattle. We're going to go in with corn and soybean now and back off the cattle, and I also have 14 colonies of bees.
Ooh, honey.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yummy. I don't know a whole lot about farming. Are you at the scale where you sell industrially, or are you a farmer's market farmer?
Half of the honey goes to a friend of mine who owns a winery, and he makes mead with it. One honey, and then the other half I do have a private label in one of my daughter's names, and I don't have to stay at the farmer's markets too long because it sells pretty quick.
All right. Well, how can we help you out today? Because we certainly cannot help you with the farming.
My wife and I are entering a different stage of life. We are going to have three revenue streams for what I consider my first retirement in about 6 years. I am concerned that while I don't need credit and my credit score is somewhere north of 725, I don't want anyone else using my credit either. So I've started looking around for different products, and some of them are quite pricey that kind of protects your credit so that someone doesn't get your name and information. And
right, a credit monitoring service.
Yes, ma'am. And yeah. I found a place called Credit Karma. It has everything I want. It has free credit. You know, you can look up your credit scores. It has really good information. But here's my concern. It's all for free.
Yep.
And I'm like, okay, well, are they going to sell my personal information? You know, how do they make their revenue? Because I don't need to give the information I'm trying to protect to a company that goes under, and all of a sudden the very thing I tried to do is the one thing I gave away.
Liz, this is a question that we actually dealt with last week on the program, credit monitoring. And I said at the time that actually I don't use a service because I monitor my finances quite closely myself. But, you know, we did have folks write in and say, well, but why shouldn't you use a credit monitoring service if you don't want to do it yourself? Your thoughts?
I think credit monitoring in general has a lot of problems with it. I'm not sure that most people need to do that. And the reason is it can get pretty expensive.
Right.
If you want anything like comprehensive coverage, most of the credit monitoring I've seen has been monitoring of just one bureau's files. And that's fine. That can give you a good idea what's going in, going out. And if they give you some kind of a score, you can see what affects it. There are some that monitor all three, but that's getting pretty spendy. And I'm not sure that most people really need to do that. Now, if you have been the victim of new account fraud, in other words, somebody has enough of your personal information to go out there and open a new account, then I might feel more comfortable with credit monitoring. But credit monitoring doesn't prevent anything.
Right.
It just gives you early warning. If your primary concern is preventing someone else from using your information to open credit accounts, I would get a credit freeze or a security freeze. And Consumers Union, the Consumer Reports parent organization, has a lot of information on their site about how to go about getting a security freeze or a credit freeze. Basically, what that does is it locks down your credit files at the three bureaus. You have to pay a fee typically to get this. And any lender who is looking at an application from a bad guy tries to go and get your file, won't get anything. It doesn't stop all fraud, but it really, really shuts the door on a lot of it.
It means that if you do go apply for credit somewhere, you will have to tell the credit bureau over the phone that it is you.
Yeah.
And that you are actually applying for this credit. So it does add an extra step if you're applying for credit.
Yeah. And there may be extra fees attached to that.
I'm certainly not opposed at waiting an extra day or making an extra phone call, just as long as everything's locked down.
Yeah.
That's what you want. That's the credit freeze is your answer rather than credit monitoring. Now, credit monitoring, if you're in credit score improvement mode and really want to know what's going on, the credit monitoring can help that way. And you mentioned Credit Karma. Credit Karma offers this for free with TransUnion. And the reason is their model is that they are going to look at your information and pair you with advertising offers. They're not going to go out and sell your personal information, as far as I understand from the research I've done. But their advertising model means they're going to look at the specifics of your financial situation and match you with advertising offers.
Oh, so they're a marketing company that brings information to themselves by using this free service to bring people in.
They also have a pretty consumer education focus to this. They really think people should know this. The one problem, besides, you know, handing over your Social Security number and other information to this organization, is that the credit score they're offering is not the FICO score. Mm-hmm. It's a TransUnion score. I believe it's a Vantage score.
Right.
You know, if you are in the market for credit monitoring and you don't want to pay a fortune for it, you know, getting it for free, not a bad deal.
Excellent.
All right. So does that help you out?
Hey, it helps me wonderfully. And I look forward to hearing y'all on podcast.
Excellent. We love our podcast listeners.
Y'all have a good evening.
All right. Thanks a lot. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can send us an email with the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And in a couple of weeks, we're going to be inviting the author of some new children's books about money to join us for this segment. So we would love to get some questions from you and your kids about money. So send those our way. We promise to wait until after the school bell rings to get you both on the phone. Liz Weston, thanks so much for being here with us today.
Thank you.
And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. It took Michelangelo more than 4 years to paint the Sistine Chapel. "Genius is eternal patience," he's quoted as saying. So we can safely assume that he would have had a great credit score. Yes, new research shows that the more patient a person you are, the higher your credit score is likely to be. Stephen Meyer co-authored the study. He's an associate professor at Columbia Business School, and his paper is in this month's Journal of Psychological Science. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tess. Thank you.
How did you determine whether someone was patient or impatient?
It's a little bit, I don't know, do you know the marshmallow studies with kids?
Yeah, but let's go ahead and explain that for our audience.
It's like an adult version of the marshmallow study, which is this famous psychology studies done in the 70s, where they bring in kids into a room and tell them, look, here you have a marshmallow. I have to leave now for 5-10 minutes. If I come back and you haven't eaten that one marshmallow, you get two. And you see that there are a lot of kids struggle with that. It's a very tempting thing to eat that marshmallow. That marshmallow is so great. But the really amazing part about that study is like about 10 years later, they go back to those kids and check out how good they do in schools. And those kids who waited longer, who didn't eat that marshmallow, are doing better in school. And so our study is kind of a replication of that in an adult version and with financial consequences. So we started with saying, do you want to have $49 now or $50 in a month? So people think about, okay, is it worth to wait like a month for this
for
extra
$1?
$1?
Yeah.
It's like, no, I take $49 now. And we say, oh, okay, great. So what about $45 now and $50 in a month? $45 now. And then we went down and down and down and down. And at one point, a lot of people switch. You know, when you get down to like, do you want to have 20 now or 50 in a month? A lot of people said, okay, it's worth waiting that extra month. And so by confronting people with a couple of those choices, we determined whether people are more or less impatient. And then we look, what consequences does that have on people's FICO score? And you see that it does. So people who are very impatient have lower scores.
Did you find actual data and numbers that showed, a FICO score differential between patient people and impatient people? And how big is that differential?
Well, you see that people are very, very impatient, fall below like the 620 FICO line, which is often used as like the subprime threshold. And
right.
People are very patient, just make it above that line. So in that sense, even though the difference in like points can be up to 30, 50, whatever FICO points, but because it's around that threshold, can have quite substantial consequences on how you get treated on the credit market or the labor market.
Then let me ask you this. You know, in the marshmallow study, when you have five-year-olds, they are at a point in their lives where perhaps you could teach them to have more patience and you could teach them the consequences of not having patience. when you're looking at adults who have pretty ingrained behaviors when it comes to saving and spending money, how do you change that behavior if you're an impatient person?
Well, I have a 1.5-year-old, and I sometimes think you can't teach the little kids anything. But I agree. It's probably easier than with adults. I still think there are ways where people can, if they want, they can deal with it if they're aware of that they have that problem. You know, I have a lot of problems going to the gym. I know that going to the gym is good for the future. It's painful now. It's actually terribly boring, I think. But it has those consequences, not today, but very positive consequences in the future. And I have a hard time doing it because I'm not that patient. So I have strategies to deal with that. You know, I team up with the buddy. Hmm. I make it almost automated. Same with finance. You know, I make like most of the things, I try to automate them so that I don't have to decide. My fridge is empty, not because I'm lazy to shop. It's because I know if it's full, I'm going to eat it.
Right.
So I think there, if you're aware that this is one of your problems and you're willing to change it, I think there are strategies around it. I also think that if you're a bank, for example, and you want to help people not default, I think knowing that impatience is a little part which drives the decision. I mean, to tell them, look, if you don't default for 2 years, I'm going to give you a price, is not going to work because that price gets discounted a lot. Who cares about the price in 2 years?
Right.
So maybe a better strategy is say, look, every month you pay, you get a little price. And so basically those upfront benefits might be more effective in helping people to stick with their payment plan and pay their bills.
Wow. So do we have a solution to the foreclosure crisis there?
I really wish I could. I mean, I like the study I have. I wouldn't generalize it to that we can solve the foreclosure crisis.
Fair enough.
With the result of my study.
Stephen Meyer is associate professor at the Columbia Business School. Thanks so much for coming in. It's been fun.
Thank you very much, Tess.
While we're on the subject of behavioral change, how are those New Year's resolutions going? The folks who get paid to study these things say our resoluteness historically lasts about 3 weeks. So, hey, better luck next year, right? But if one of your promises was to lose weight, you're about to wish you worked at one of these companies because they pay you to shed the pounds. Why would they do that? Well, because studies show people who exercise and eat right miss less work, are more productive, and file fewer health insurance claims. From Colorado Public Radio, Eric Whitney reports.
When he gets to the office on Monday mornings, the first thing Andy Casper does is log in at a computer.
Please enter your password.
But this isn't the computer at his desk. It's connected to a scale he's standing on, right in the employee break room behind a little partition.
Weight measurement taken. Please step off scale.
This was a good Monday.
Why was this a good Monday?
I lost 1.5 pounds over the weekend, so
all right.
I figure any weekend you lose is a good weekend.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Andy, an IT supervisor, is a big guy, but not as big as he used to be. This talking scale has helped him drop his weight from 273 pounds to 235. That's 40 pounds in 4 months. Casper says he wants to lose 40 more by August and says he's already seeing benefits.
My wife, I find out she's a little more, cuddly at night,
The benefits aren't just on the home front. Andy's employer, hospital company Health One, pays him to leave the lard behind.
I got my first check Saturday for $60.
Not a ton of money, but Andy says it still felt good to get the check.
It wasn't the $60. It was, wow, I lost that much weight to get to $60.
The more you lose, the more you get paid. A company called Incenta Health came up with the program as a way to keep people motivated. Companies pay Incenta Health to set up the computerized scales in their offices. They send employees daily tips on healthy eating and exercise. People who lose weight earn cash and gift certificates. They keep track of their progress on their email and smartphones.
And once you sign up, you're going to get a custom exercise plan and meal plan every day that you're in the program.
Todd McGuire is Incenta Health's chief tech officer. He says it doesn't work for everybody. Only about half of those who sign up for the weight loss coaching stick with it after 6 months. But McGuire says most of the employees who keep weighing in lose enough weight to positively impact their health, about 12 pounds a year. And if staying true to personal goals isn't enough to keep people motivated, you can join a team and challenge others to beat you and your coworkers.
And there's a leaderboard on the website that shows The Slimming Divas is in second place and has lost 8% of their body weight, and they earn a team prize.
People say the biggest motivator to lose weight, though, is pictures.
Oh, man, you don't want to see my first one. It was terrible. I mean, it was terrible.
Yep, the internet-enabled scale also has a camera. It takes your picture every time you weigh in. Tanya Amaro uses one of the high-tech scales at the hospital she works at downtown. She says scrolling through her pictures over time is really effective.
So do you see these pictures again later?
Oh, yeah. You'll get an email when it's gotten your weight. You can see your pictures from the very beginning, first weight, till now. It's awesome.
Companies pay about $35 a year per employee to have the computerized scales in their offices. Incenta Health says companies who use the scales save 3 to 4 times that because healthier employees cost less in health claims and they're more productive. At least one big employer, Kaiser Permanente in Colorado, confirms the savings. That's great for the bosses, but for worker bees like Andy Casper, the IT manager, there are things like leaving his size 44 pants on the dressing room floor and stepping out in a new pair of 38s.
I smiled the whole day, from ear to ear. I haven't seen 38 since about 12 years ago. When I put them on and I didn't have to suck in my gut or anything, I just come out of the dressing room. My wife says, they fit. And her eyes got big and my eyes got big and she gave me a big hug. I'm so proud of you. And so it's like, that was cool.
So far, Incenta Health has installed its computerized scales at the offices of about a dozen big companies across the country. They're now experimenting with how to make them available to the general public outside of workplace settings. In Denver, I'm Eric Whitney for Marketplace.
Got an idea for a new business? Maybe you just need some seed money to get going and then you're off to becoming a millionaire, right? Well, for some lucky entrepreneurs, though that depends on your definition of luck, there's a reality show made just for you.
I could ask for 50% and say, let's be even. I ask for only 40% out of respect for your talent. I just want to bring my 35 years of savvy business experience that took $1,000 and turned it into $66 million, which was no accident. And bring it to your table to help you.
A new season of Shark Tank premieres this weekend on ABC. A panel of 5 wealthy business owners sits in judgment as wannabes pitch their ideas. Barbara Corcoran is one of those judges. Her qualifications are that she turned a $1,000 loan into a $6 billion real estate empire. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
So you started off with just $1,000 to start your business. Where did that money come from?
I slept with my boyfriend and he gave it to me.
Wow. So it works, huh?
It certainly does work. But let me tell you, I would have slept with him anyway. He was so handsome, 10 years older than me, so sexy. He didn't have to give me the money, but once it was there, boy, I grabbed it.
All right. Well, so that's perhaps for a different show. But
hey, let's do this again.
Tell us, you know, how you ended up parlaying that $1,000 into a huge conglomeration.
Well, that's a big question, and it was 25 years of a lot of hustle and a lot of hard work. 25 years of trying to spot the losers from the winners and the people I hired and surrounded myself with. 25 years, I got a theme thing going here. You like it? You like it?
I do.
I think I'll drop to 25 now, even I'm bored on it. Okay, among 10,000 million other things that worked and didn't work along the way.
Sure. What about just plain learning the mechanics of owning your own business? I mean, there are a lot of money skills that you need to put into practice if you're doing that. Did you have those skills? And if not, how did you get them?
I didn't have those skills. I never learned those skills. And I still don't have those skills today.
Absolutely.
I never could read a financial statement. If I would talk with a bank, there was never a chance I was going to get a loan because I didn't know what the heck I was talking about. That was not my skill. My skill was marketing and people management. But one of those great advantages to having that skill was I was able to identify good talent.
Well, so being able to identify good talent is your primary job on the show Shark Tank. You are the only woman investor on that panel. And I wonder if there are maybe one or two elements that you think stand out in what you're really looking for from potential winners.
Absolutely. There's something that happens on Shark Tank that you don't know if you're watching at home, and that is when that poor entrepreneur, and I say poor entrepreneur, I don't mean financially, it's just they don't know what's going to hit them. When they walk through that Shark Tank and stand on that stage, the producer plays a little trick on them. They say to them before they get on the stage, don't speak until a shark talks to you. And what do they tell the sharks in our ears? Because we have those little earpieces, they say, don't talk to them for 5 minutes. Now, what do you think happens to that person who's already neurotic with giant cameras in their face zooming around them? They fall apart for the most part. And by the time they start pitching, they have only half their power left. Do you know what? For the most part, the great majority of them, you know what I'm doing? I'm deciding already whether I have any interest in investing in that business or not, because I'm watching that individual and seeing how good they are under pressure.
Just while they're being silent on stage for 5 minutes.
It's terrible. Any grown man or grown woman in that position, it ain't so easy because you don't know what the agenda is. But here's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for someone who's going to be good under pressure, because what I've learned in business, it's not about the high times, the good times, the creative ideas, the winners, the whatever it is. It's really when all the chips are against you, when the economy has fallen apart, when there are no buyers out there, when you owe money to everybody, you know you're going to go out of business because there's no way you can hang on for a minute longer. That's when you need someone who is just not going to give up.
When we're talking about small business owners, entrepreneurs, is there still a difference in the challenges women face versus men?
I know the right answer is to say yes. Of my own personal experience was that I had a huge advantage being a woman building my big company. I feel I have a huge advantage on Shark Tank being a female with all men. Okay,
why?
I wish there was another female. Because I have a different perspective, right? When I built the Corcoran Group and walked into a room of all the old boy networks who owned and controlled the real estate in New York City, I was the only girl in a skirt. And so I could really ramp it up and wear a short skirt, which I religiously did, and make it red and go into that room with a red power suit on, really too short, and high heels because I, thank God, good legs, right? So why was that an advantage? They didn't even have to know my name. I was just the woman or the girl or the one in the short skirt, who cares, as long as I was noticed. So I already got my undue attention that those guys in the most expensive $5,000 suits could never get. On Shark Tank, all right, I'm the only female. Half people don't even know my name. They go, oh, you're the woman on Shark Tank. They can't say that to the guys. You're the guy on Shark Tank. They got to remember their name, remember what they do, right? So it's a huge advantage on Shark Tank to be female. I frankly think it should be 4 women on that show and 1 man, and they do a lot more business, for sure. But that's just not the way it is.
Barbara, thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Barbara Corcoran is founder of the Corcoran Group Real Estate Company, author of the book Shark Tales, and panelist on the reality show Shark Tank on ABC. And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to Greenfield, Wisconsin, and the home of listener Claudia Riley. Ms. Riley wrote on her Facebook page that she wants a piggy to give to her 25-year-old daughter, who, quote, soaked me financially for a wedding in July and the down payment of her home in December. I will put my last penny in there, she says, and allow her to start saving for her future progeny. Sorry, no, I am not giving you a piggy to give to your daughter. You've done enough. Thank you very much. I am giving him to you. I want the two of you to work together to rebuild that nest egg that you so lovingly gave away. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us and me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, jobs and lifestyle go head to head as one Wisconsin community confronts the growing pains of a mineral boom.
It's split neighborhoods and families. You know, one faction wants to sell the family farm for sand, and the other faction don't want to see grandpa's farm dumped down an oil hole or a gas well someplace.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Sasha Woodruff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. This is APM, American Public Media.